This is the way you want to look at. Would you want your family living there?
Yeah.
I'm not talking about like your personal, like, you know, likes or dislikes, or I want to be in a big city. No, I mean, just like if this was a place where you were going to live, let's say it was free, would you still want to live there?
That's a good point. Always try to view things through the buyer's lens, through their perspective. Put yourself in their shoes. What are they going to be looking at?
Right. And if there's something like, yeah, but I would need XYZ to say, okay, well then think about XYZ is going to be money. That's what that's going to be. It's going to need to take a hit on the price.
Welcome to Turning Profit, a podcast for people that love real estate. Learn the business models and skills that professional real estate investors use to make money and build wealth. Visit turningprofit.com for a wealth of investor resources. And now, here are your hosts, Pete and Heather Reese.
Welcome to the Turning Profit Podcast. Heather, it's so great to be here once again.
It is.
It is great. Yeah. Yes. Today we've got a very exciting topic, and I know I say that all the time, but this one is an important episode because we're talking about 12 critical mistakes you can make when buying a piece of land. If you miss one of these, you really could be in a world of hurt, I guess you could say.
Well, that's not dramatic at all.
Well, no, it's not dramatic.
But true. Right, but when you say you're excited, it's because you truly are excited about each of these topics. That's what's so funny. I know a lot of people will be like, I'm so excited about something, and they're like, they're done filming a podcast. They're like, that sucked.
Yeah,
you truly are excited.
I am excited,
about this.
Yes. Yeah. And I'm excited because if you follow these tips, you can hopefully avoid buying a piece of crap property.
Well,
you know, I don't want to see you make mistakes, I guess, is the big thing. And these are mistakes. Many of these mistakes I've made.
Yeah. Like learn from our mistakes or Pete's mistakes as I'm perfect. But I'm sorry, what did you just do?
Yeah. Nothing.
Yeah. I'll have to watch this episode on YouTube. Anyways, but you do take it when you hear someone make a mistake in land, even if you had nothing to do with the transaction, they didn't, you know, follow our training program or anything, you will stew on it and you feel like...
Yeah, I kind of feel bad, like it's my fault somehow, but it's not, I know. But
like, I'll be like, well, did they do our training? No, actually, they just found us after they made the mistake. I'm like, okay, I'm sure there's some sort of deep-rooted issue we can delve into, but
possibly.
You're not responsible for everyone's feelings.
Okay.
They're responsible for their feelings and actions. There we go. So I haven't even read the cheat sheet, which I normally don't read. So do you want to just kind of like jump in after you tell everyone who you are in case they don't know and why you are qualified to talk about this?
Yeah. Okay. Well, if you don't know me, my name is Pete Reese and been in the land business, land-focused business since... I guess the end of 2020, but really we did our first land transaction in March of 2021. So a little over 3 years now, built things up considerably since then. Our first year, we did about $1.2 million in revenue. Second year, did about $3.4 and some change. Third year, which was 2023, did about $8.2 million in revenue. And we're shooting for $20 million in revenue in 2024. We'll see how it turns out.
Yeah, a lot of people spent their COVID lockdown doing sourdough. You did it in
sourdough
bread. You did it in, you know, really getting into the nitty gritty of land. You already came to this with some real estate knowledge,
yes,
correct, right?
Some knowledge, yeah. You know, I've been a real estate investor since the early 2000s, but also a licensed real estate broker in California since 2006. Now, I don't use my real estate license for any of the stuff that we're doing right now, but it did give me a good base to really understand transactions and the real estate market and everything like that. So I've been fully involved in real estate for quite some time, and I love being on the investment side of things. That's really kind of where my passion is. And if you don't know about this business, this particular business model, it's about buying and selling properties and holding them for as short as possible and making as much profit as you can.
Right. And on this podcast, we talk about our insight into land. Pete's not your broker.
No,
you
I'm
should
not.
Get your own. Anything he says is not to be construed.
Most of the time, I'm not my own broker even.
That's the funny part, right?
Yep.
I look back on, I also had my real estate license for a while. And I look back in our actual formal training. And how much of that we use? No, not much at all. No, I mean, I'm not trying to be like funny or anything. Like we truly don't use much of what actually learned the book way. It's about from transactions.
Yes, definitely.
Like learning by doing is way more important. And the other thing that when we first were licensed and got into real estate, message boards just started, right? And we learned so much from them, but they've come such a long way. And we actually have our own kind of community, which is, gosh, it would have blown me out of the like, it would have blown my mind if I had had that resource when we first started getting into real estate, doing the old school message boards.
Yeah. So if you want to find our community, it's called Land Conquest, and you can find it simply by going to landconquest.com, and then you'll get directed to the community where we've got, you know, we had over 4,000 members of our community.
Oh, really? Now. That's
so
awesome.
Yeah, so we have over 4,000 members. We do regular Zoom calls on there as well, where we evaluate deals, and we've got some free training that we give out as well.
This episode's actually filmed before a live studio audience.
Oh, it is. Okay, our dogs.
We have two Shih Tzus that are joining us for this, so if you hear anything, that's who that is.
They're our producers.
Exactly. They keep us honest.
Yeah, so that's another thing that happened during the pandemic. We got our puppy.
Right,
Pandemic puppy.
Land and that, and then our pandemic puppy develops separation anxiety because she was never alone. So we got her a dog who has generalized anxiety. So yeah, we're really winning, but they're amazing. We love them. So good things came. I mean, not good things came out of the pandemic, but we used our time.
I tried to be very, very productive in my time.
Right.
So I don't know about anyone else, but
I should say the lockdown portion, not the pandemic in a whole. Anyway, so that went off topic. Let's get started with the your first thing. You give these bullet points, but I'm going to let you start with this.
Yeah. So these are 12 critical mistakes that you would hopefully avoid when you're buying a piece of land.
Have you made all of these mistakes? Or are these just, like, tell me if you made one of these so
I can make fun of you. Okay, as we're going through it, I'll tell you if I made it.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So number one, buying a property to build a home without ensuring that it is actually a buildable property.
Yeah, that would really suck if your goal was to, like, sell it to a builder or for building potential and then you realize you can't actually build on it.
Yeah.
And that, I think going into it, a lot of people who are buying land think everything's buildable. Well, if it's land, unless it's like a lake, they're like, you should be able to build on it, right? And that's not the case.
So there are a number of things. Different areas have different requirements for determining whether a property is buildable or not. The thing that we see most often come up is the ability to have a septic system or a sewage processing system. Basically, you've got waste in your home, and if you're in kind of an urban or suburban area, a lot of times you're connecting to a sewer system. But if you're in a rural area or an area that doesn't have a sewer system, then you are going to be looking to do an on-site disposal system, meaning a septic system. And in order to build on those types of properties, you need to be your property needs to be able to support that. Typically, it's testing the soil, seeing how high the water table is, seeing if it's the right type of soil. Those are the main factors. Some areas have alternative systems that you can use no matter what the soil conditions are or anything like that. But generally, those are very expensive. And some areas don't allow you to use those alternative systems.
And they're like unsightly too because they're normally above ground, right?
Right. Yeah.
And so, you don't really want to be like, oh, that's the poop tank.
Oh, that's my tank of crap.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no. Now it's like I'm unlocked a middle school boy and pee here.
Okay. So that's one big thing. Mm-hmm. The other thing is water availability. Now, sometimes you might have a property that, you know, it doesn't have municipal water service. So you mm-hmm. can't connect to that. But in rural areas, most people drill a well. Mm-hmm. Now, some areas, the water is way too deep, or maybe there's no water at all.
Right.
So if you don't have water, it's tough to build a home there. And some areas require you to have a water source, an on-site water source, in order to actually build. Now, I know it's possible to import water into some areas, have big water tanks and import it and things like that. But some areas won't let you build if you don't have this kind of on-site capacity for water. They're doing some cool things these days. You're actually able to get water out of the atmosphere. But those require electricity. And if you're in a super hot, dry climate, there's not really much water to be pulled from the air anyhow.
Kind of a cool idea though. I mean, it's kind of like your dehumidifier. We're by the ocean, so we have dehumidifiers. Same kind of thing. You're just creating that,
yeah,
the way to leach the moisture out of it.
I didn't put access to electricity because mm-hmm. that's less of a thing because with solar panels and battery backup systems and things like that. So you can build in a lot of areas that previously would have been tough to build in mm-hmm. because you didn't have power mm-hmm. unless you just wanted to live without power, but it's tough to live a modern life without it.
Right. You'd have to have some pretty good backup. So in case you get cloudy weather for, you know, extended period of time or.
Yeah.
But those are all, there's tons of people that live off the grid
mm-hmm.
that make it work.
But there's solutions now to getting mm-hmm. power even on those off-grid places, whether it be solar or wind even, you mm-hmm. know, you can have your own windmills or you can even use like a stream for, you know, to run a turbine or something like that.
Or like a hamster farm with the wheels.
You could have a hamster army, you know, generating your electricity. Or you could have one of those bikes hooked up to the TV where you, you know, ride your bike for exercise.
Oh, you
want to
watch TV? Get on the bike. Yeah. There we go.
That was like a thing in the 80s, I think.
That would do, if you, internet for me, I would do that.
You would? Okay.
Well, yeah, I'm addicted to internet, so that would probably work for me.
Yep. So, okay, so that was number one. Mm-hmm. Buying a property for a buildable purpose, and it's not actually buildable. Mm-hmm. Don't do that. So, and we have bought property like that. Small property, which we thought was buildable. We were going to resell it as a buildable property. Learned that it wasn't buildable. And just got out of it without losing money. But it could have easily happened where we lost money on the deal, which I don't want to do.
So are you going to talk about how you mitigate that?
Yeah, you do your research ahead of time. With a lot of these things, it's about doing your research, mm-hmm. doing your due diligence, and calling up the county, seeing what they require to build. You know, mm-hmm. you're going through all these things, and then you're just confirming that you're able to actually do it.
Right, and don't be afraid to walk away.
Yep.
You know, don't try to make something work that's just is going to be more hassle than you'll get out of it, because you're going to lock up your money in something that you're going to have to fight to get out of.
Yep. And in those two examples that I gave, you're probably going to have to bring in some experts to confirm those things. You might have to hire a soil scientist to do a perk test to make sure that you can have an on-site sewage disposal system. Or for water availability, you may have to hire a well driller to come out and actually drill a well and make sure that there's water actually underneath the ground.
Yeah. You always say like you make money when you buy. And I think you also, what is that? You don't lose money when you buy. I don't know. Like, what's the other part of that?
I don't know.
I'll
have to come up with some sort of phrase for you there, Heather.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Hey, everyone. Just a quick reminder that you can join our community for free at landconquest.com. Inside, you'll get all the resources, training, and support for building a thriving land flipping business. Once again, that's landconquest.com. All right. Enjoy the rest of the show. Okay. Moving on to number two, buying land next to a bad neighbor. This is a critical mistake you can make if you're buying a piece of land and you end up next to a bad neighbor. So it could just be a guy or a girl that is just a terrible neighbor. You know,
they could be
someone that carries guns around and threatens you, or just is in your business and it's just a bad neighbor. Or it could be other things that are a bad neighbor. Now, one of the examples that I'd like to give is, say you're next to a huge cemetery. Now, those neighbors are very quiet.
I was going to say they're very quiet, but...
You know, at least during the day. But it's going to decrease the property value. Obviously, there's not many people that are very interested in being next to a large cemetery. Could be a dump. Someone has a big junkyard. Our kids just recently had a transaction. Our kids buy and sell land as well. And they bought a piece of property. It was a beautiful piece of property, a couple acres. But the next door neighbor, when you look in the satellite images, it's like that they were running, a major junkyard. They had this major junkyard right next to their property. And there was trees in between, so you really couldn't see from their property to the next property. But the thing about it was that it actually caused them to actually have to sell that property for a lot less than they anticipated. They thought they had it factored into the price, but they didn't factor in enough. And ultimately, it was very hard to sell. There weren't many people that were interested in dealing with that neighbor. And I don't know who ultimately bought the property, but the person that bought the property, maybe it was a neighbor. I don't know. So a couple other bad neighbor type things in this category would be some bad smells. If you're next to a mushroom farm or something like that, that would be considered a bad neighbor. It's going to decrease the value of your property. These are things you can't tell from looking at satellite images sometimes. Also, a commercial business. Now, I remember you telling me about your school, that one of your schools that you went to had a crematorium near
it. It was a gymnastics.
Oh, a gymnastics place. Okay, they had a crematorium near it. So obviously, you know, it puts some weird smells in the air, and you know what that smell is. It's not very settling, I guess.
Thankfully, I didn't know for a long time
that smell was.
They lied to us.
Did they?
And they said it was, I can't remember what it was. It was like some sort of, manufacturing something. And then we drove that direction one time and it was like crematorium. And I was like,
yeah,
what the? But they said, don't worry, they only did it in the evening.
Okay. Yeah. They only burn the bodies in the evening. Okay. So it could be other types of commercial businesses as well. It could be you know, someone that operates a loud equipment, mm-hmm. could be
chemicals. That's a big thing, like in some chemicals, of these areas,
yeah.
You know, where they're doing some stuff that could be carcinogens or just could, you know, the implication. Yeah. Do you want to raise a family with small children around something that's, you know,
most people don't. So those all affect the property values and they all make the properties difficult to resell. Mm-hmm. So that's just really keep those in mind.
Just think of it this way. Like if you were searching for, because this is the way you want to look at, would you want your family living there?
Yeah.
No, and I'm not talking about like your personal, like, you know, likes or dislikes, or I want to be in a big city. No, I mean, just like if this was a place where you were going to live, let's say it was free, would you still want to live there? You know, and if there's something that would make you kind of.
That's a good point. Mm-hmm. Always try to view things through the buyer's lens, through their perspective.
Right.
Put yourself in their shoes. What are they going to be looking at?
Right. And if there's something like, yeah, but I would need XYZ to say, okay, well then think about XYZ is going to be money. That's what that's going to be. It's going to need to take a hit on the price.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the other thing is number three, buying land in the FEMA flood zone and or wetlands. Mm-hmm. So I put these kind of in the both in the same category, but they're really two different things. These are things that the FEMA flood zone, essentially this is where the water level comes up to when it rains heavy, you know, and they have different designations for, you know, how often it floods in this particular area and everything like that. But you can look these things up on our software that we use to evaluate land. FEMA flood zone is one of those things that it may look like a completely dry, perfect property, but when the rain comes, this could be completely underwater. It could be a lake. So it's very important to look into that before you actually buy a piece of land, because it really affects things, especially in areas where it rains a lot.
Or even in areas where it doesn't, though, because if it's like a 100-year flood, right? Mm-hmm. Let's say it's... they don't anticipate it's still going to affect, like, because that's going to come up.
Yep.
The end buyer is going to be like, okay, yeah, I'm not too worried about it flooding. However,
yep.
For, you know, future resale value.
Yeah. And wetlands is another thing I mentioned here. Wetlands, it may not be 100% evident. There's different grades of wetlands, mm-hmm. and things. But if you have wetlands on the property, you likely can't build on that spot. So that could be very impactful on the property value and whether someone's actually going to want to buy the property or not. So those are two important things. In FEMA flood zone, a lot of times you can build within the FEMA flood zone, but it's going to require some extra work in order to make that happen. Some areas will allow it, some areas won't actually, but I don't know if you've ever been in areas where it floods a lot. They build homes on stilts. That's a common thing. Sometimes they allow you to import dirt in order to raise the value, raise the level of the land up outside of the flood zone. So you could build up this big mound, put your house on it, and then you get it like a big, big lake around it when it floods. So those things are all costly though, and not the most desirable. So you really need to know about those things before you buy a piece of property so you can either factor it into the price, mm-hmm. or decide you want to pass on it altogether. So that's another critical mistake that I see investors made, and I've made that mistake before too, buying a property where I didn't realize there was wetlands. Now it's always something that we always check out. Buying land next to train tracks or a major freeway.
I think that goes without saying, but you know, like you wouldn't care about trains, but I would.
Okay.
Right? So therefore, I mean, just some raw stats, 50% of the population is probably going to care. You and I both might care about being, I don't know, right next to an airport. Right?
Mm-hmm.
For lots of different reasons. I don't want all that pollutants from the planes kind of breathing that in. The sound, I don't know, I'm paranoid, maybe an accident, all these sorts of things. Same thing with freeways. Most people are going to care about a freeway.
Yeah.
Right?
Unless you have a billboard service or something like that. You want to put billboards up.
Well, but that would be like a commercial use, and maybe you would buy it just for that one reason if that was allowed.
Potentially, yes.
You know?
But I think that some people, you know, investors might look at things on a map and say, okay, well, it's beside a major road, that's mm-hmm. fine or whatever. But then when they really really evaluate what it's like, it could be a four-lane freeway in each direction with never-ending noise, mm-hmm. constant pollution, and you know, it's going to really affect the value of the property. So it may look like it has great access. You can't even access the property from these major freeways. Right. So I see that mistake being made as well.
Yeah, but it's like so, on the freeway. So yeah,
they're not going to let you put a driveway on the major
freeway. From the freeway. That's just not going to happen, no.
Yeah, so, but we're going to get into driveways mm-hmm. later also.
But okay. Those would be like forcing a deal, by the way. Those would be like, well, it's here, but no.
Yeah, so next, number five, buying land with huge power lines or gas easements without factoring it into the pricing. Now, when you see these huge transmission lines in a particular area, it's common that they're cutting through a lot of these rural properties. You also might see that the gas lines cutting through a particular area as well, depending on what area you're in. So these gas lines, you can't see them, but they're underground. And generally, it's like a cleared line through a property. And if you don't see power lines, there's a good chance that there's gas lines or some sort of oil pipeline or something like that that's just if got this like huge cleared area.
Obvious. Yeah, like, yeah. Like the rest of the place might be, you know, more natural, overgrown, but these are like
Yeah, it might look cool that there's a road going through your property or something like that, but really you can't do anything. You can't probably even can't put, you know, pavement over that area or anything
Can't drive on it.
Or... Yeah, I mean, it's an easement and you can cross over it generally, but you can't do much else other than that. You certainly can't build on it. So like I said, it's common in a lot of these rural areas, but you've got to factor that in. You've got to fact, typically they're going to have setbacks for building as well. So you got to understand what it is that you're buying, factor it into the pricing, see if you can do what you think you're going to be able to do and see how it affects things. Now, like if it's not a large property and you've got these huge transmission lines running through it, it might show on paper you've got a 10 acre property, but 7 out of 10 acres are under power lines.
Mm-hmm. And there's, and like
you really have to understand
one
that.
Acre here, 1 acre on the other side, and then another acre over here. It's
what are you going to do with that?
Right. Yeah.
Even if you do have the area to build next to that, how many people are going to want to live next to a huge power line type situation?
Like no,
that?
I can hear like buzzing from those.
Yeah.
So the last thing I'm going to do is, you know, and I have no idea. I don't know if there is any sort of truth to like if that is negatively impacts your health. I don't know. And if I don't know, I'm not going to go for it. So most people are not going
to
go for
it. Doesn't sound fun to me.
No.
Okay. Number six, buying land without confirming access.
Really sucks.
Well, this is a thing that happens sometimes. I mean, especially I see investors do it, you know, like they will buy a piece of property and just assume that the dirt road that leads to this property is legal access.
Mm-hmm. The thing is that, because it makes sense. Like in your mind, you're thinking, well, no one can. Like there can't be a piece of land that doesn't have access. And access meaning that like actual access where you could drive a car onto it, you could put a driveway, like actual
access. Legal access, legal access. Deeded access.
It doesn't, but it logically, it doesn't make sense to people to think that that could be an issue. But hello, we're here to tell you it could be a, you know,
yeah,
a huge
issue.
It
happens a lot. We get a lot of properties in, a lot of potential deals in where they're landlocked. I mean, they don't have any legal or sometimes even physical access. So there may be, you know, it's like this island in between other properties when you look at it on a map. So it's very important to determine if you've got actual legal access to the property. And if you don't, I would recommend not buying. But I mean, I don't buy landlocked properties. Maybe you get it like ultra cheap and you've got a deal worked out to sell it to another neighbor or something. You know, there's ways to make some of those work sometimes, but I don't mess with them.
That's a specialty. You know. That's like starting a new business. That's, we've talked about it, that maybe we would hire someone that would just work on those, right? You could get them locked up and then you figure out a way to get the access and you go from there. But we're talking about just traditional or normal buy, sell, you know, quickly move properties. That's not normally a very quick way to move properties.
Exactly. Okay, so make sure to confirm access. Don't make that mistake. Number seven, buying a lot and assuming you can connect to existing utilities. I've made this mistake before. Mm-hmm. Typically, these would be like sewer service or water service, you know, municipal, you know, utilities.
Right, where it'd be like a property that it's all, everything's built up. Everyone's on sewer. Everyone has electricity. Everyone has water. You're thinking, well, good, it's all here, right?
Yeah.
Not something you have to worry about. And then you realize, yeah, if you want to wait the 16 years on the wait list.
Yes. Some of these areas have these moratoriums, you know, like, oh, they're going to build a new sewage processing plant. And they're not allowing any new connections to the sewer until this plant is done, which may or may not ever get done in the near future. Or water meters, that happens a lot. Sometimes areas don't issue new water meters because they don't have the additional capacity. So there may be a water line running right in front of the property, but if you can't connect to it, what good is it?
Right. It's even worse.
Yes.
You know, it's like.
So make sure to do your research. Call the utilities. Find out if you can connect and just kind of ensure that. So that's a big critical mistake somehow.
The big takeaway is don't assume. Don't make any sort of assumptions.
Yep.
Always verify it. Make sure you have a paper trail. You know, do so much research that you're like abundantly clear that this is okay to do.
Yeah. Number eight, buying land without checking the zoning for your intended use. Okay. So say you buy a piece of property and you're like, this is right along a major road. I'm going to put up a stand selling pumpkins.
You know? Okay. I'm there for that.
Yep. So you buy it with this intended purpose. Come to find out, the zoning does not allow anything like that. It's only residential uses. You can't have any sort of commercial operation or anything like mm-hmm. that. So you just bought a property that you can't use for what you thought you were going to use it for. And ultimately, the value may be different because of that.
Right, because no one wants to live in an area that would be perfect for a pumpkin. Like, you know, because if you're only used as a residential mm-hmm. and it's...
or you want to open up a junkyard. You think it's a great spot for mm-hmm. a junkyard. And they don't allow you to put a junkyard there.
So, yeah, figure out what the zoning, the best use of it is, and then make sure that you can actually do whatever you want.
Yeah, and a lot of times you can look up that information in a particular area online. Mm-hmm. They've got these tables and charts which show you what the zoning designation is and what types of uses you can do within that zoning. So, you know, a lot of times it's a 100-page PDF that you kind of have to sort through in order to get that information, but it's all there generally online. And if you can't find it online, you can always call the county or the city or whoever and ask them, you're thinking about doing and ask them if they think it's okay.
Right. And the other thing too, I think you've pointed out in a past episode was that like a certain zoning code here might have the same numbers and everything, but mean something different somewhere else.
Yes.
So don't be like, oh, I know what R whatever means and think, okay, that means I can put, you know, 12 houses on it or something. Make sure that locally it means the exact same thing.
Yep. Each area's got their own stuff. Are you looking to scale your land flipping business quickly? Well, we're happy to present our new cutting edge system built specifically for land flippers. Take a look at the Land Conquest business system today and you'll gain full access to a customizable pre-made website, CRM, dedicated phone numbers, text automations, 24/7 support, and more. It's basically a business in the box. Go to software.landconquest.com to learn more. Okay, number 9, Heather. This is another critical mistake that you can make. This is a fatal mistake. Buying land on a busy road and assuming you can get a driveway put on it.
Right. This is a little different than a freeway. Like a freeway, like obviously that makes sense. But some of these kind of more bigger roads, they're actually sectioned off so that because they don't want the flow of traffic being impeded.
Right.
So it might be like, oh, great. It's on this major road. Perfect.
Yeah.
Not so perfect.
Could be a great spot.
Yeah.
Could even be like a dirt path to get onto your mm-hmm. property. But if you're going to build a home there, you need to ensure that you can actually put an actual driveway on there. Mm-hmm. And a lot of areas will make you get a permit for a driveway. And the decision may not be up to you. It might be up to whoever the road department is in that particular state or county or something like that. And so you better make sure that you're able to put a drive. If it's a busy road, I would definitely check ahead of time to make sure you can put a driveway on there because it's not guaranteed. And if you can't put a driveway on there, what are you going to do?
Right. Well, and I don't know if you have this down there too, but let's say you have kind of a flagpole lot. Do you talk about that?
Flag lot? No, I don't.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's rules that the driveway, you're thinking, oh, this would be plenty of room. But no, because it has to have, if it's too far back, it has to be able to have a fire truck on it or
needs
to be able to turn around. You know, there needs to be certain amounts of space. So it's all these little things that you just have to kind of ask. You'll start to learn. You'll look at that and you'll be like, okay, that's a really, really slender driveway. What are the rules here? And you'll figure that out.
Yeah, certain areas we've seen it too, where it's a flag lot. You know, it's basically a long, narrow, you know, cut a corridor getting back to the main portion of the property. We've seen it before where an area might have a requirement that that be 30 feet wide
right.
in order for you to make it a buildable property. And it might only be 20 feet.
Right. And like us just looking at it, you're thinking, oh, that's plenty of space. That's mm-hmm. perfect. Now we've got this is a perfect driveway. And then, not so fast.
So call to confirm. Check that stuff out. Mm-hmm. Okay, number 10, buying land without researching easements. Okay, mm-hmm. easements are things that go along with the property, and many times these are easements on the property that actually kind of restrict the use or give the use to someone else for their use.
Right, we talked about it before, like the one where, you know, the SDG&E or not SDG&E, I'm talking about here, like the gas pipes, this is different. They might not actually even have anything on there. There might be nothing actually on the land. There's no pipes, there's no wires, they're not cutting the land, nothing. Like there's nothing there, but they have the right to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the problem lies, is that that area can never be built on.
Yeah.
Because they always have the right to use it for whatever they need.
Yeah.
So maybe it was purchased as part of like a future plan. They didn't do it, but they might, or I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, so utilities, that's a big thing. So it could be water, it could be gas lines, it could be an oil pipeline, it could be anything like that, power lines, anything that cuts through the property, or at least they have the right to cut through the property in a certain area. Sometimes it's right-of-ways for neighbors. Maybe the neighbors have the right to drive through your property to get to their property, to access to their property. So that's a common thing. Another thing is our conservation easements. So sometimes people, for a for various reasons, a lot of times for tax reasons or something like that, they may put a conservation easement on their property, restricting the use for anything aside from conservation. Mm-hmm. So they could have designated the property as some sort of wildlife conservation area, sell it to you, and then you thought you were going to be able to build on the property or something like that, but then come to find out that it's a permanent conservation easement on the property that you can't do anything about, and then you can't do much aside from setting it aside for the animals.
Right. So. Yeah. It'll be like because they did some sort of research and they found that a endangered frog or toad or a plant, an endangered plant or a bird or insects use those plants. I mean, there's so many different ones that they will do that. They could also use it as mitigation for that. So they want, say they had 10 acres and they set aside 2 acres that they separated that are just for that so that they can build on the other ones.
Yeah.
But that last one can never be used. And for good reason. So it's, it's not harping on that. It's just more that you need to be aware of exactly what you're buying and understanding that if it has something like that, it's not going to be something you can just go before the local community, government and be like, I've decided to put a house here.
Right.
Forget those frogs. Like, I'm done with them.
Forget the frogs. Okay. Number 11, buying land without a title policy. Ooh, or a title search even. So this is a critical mistake that I see people make sometimes.
This and not using a title, like a closing
company. Yeah, all kind of in the same category.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They go the same way. This is like the most frustrating thing for me because we've seen, how many times have we seen stuff like this where it's come back to it? There has been a problem.
Yep. So first of all, you want to ensure that there's clear title of the property. Mm-hmm. So the person that you're talking to that's supposedly able to sell you this property, you need to ensure that they actually have the ownership of that property and the full right to sell that property.
They might think they do.
Right.
They
might, yes.
They've
been paying taxes for the past 20 years on the property.
Great-grandma Frances left it to me. She said I could have it.
Yeah, but typically we see these types of issues come up with heir-type situations because someone may have said, like, hey, I'm leaving this property to you. The person that then was left the property, just realized that they just thought that they owned the property. Mm-hmm. They were paying the property taxes. They were maintaining it, doing everything. Come to find out the estate rules may be different in that particular area. And unless there's some sort of instructions otherwise, there may be, multiple heirs that have an ownership right in that property. Mm-hmm. They may not even know that they have the ownership right, but a title search in that particular area will dig that up. And obviously, if you don't have all the sellers on board in order to sell a property, then you're going to have a problem. So I see some problems happen sometimes when investors buy properties directly from a property owner, and they may have thought they'd done the research, or they may see the deed that says it's in their name or something like that. They deed them the property, but come to find out there's a cloud on the title because other people actually owned a portion of that property, and this person that they got the property deeded from didn't actually have the full ownership. So that's a big problem, and that's why we use closing companies to then do a title search and then issue a title policy.
Right, and it protects you to make sure that the person you're talking to is actually the person, like they're not pretending to be somebody else who owns the property.
Yeah.
I mean, going back to your last scenario, the thing that I always find that is interesting in that is that the person might say, oh, okay, my cousins also own it. Well, I mean, they haven't cared about this property at all. I'm sure that they have no problem. They know that I own it.
Yeah.
Well, when the cousins find out that they have an interest in it, suddenly this is the most valuable property on the planet. Suddenly
money.
Now
yes.
They are like, well, nope, my uncle told me that it's worth, 10 times what you're selling it or 20 times or 100 times what you're selling it for. So now I need a lot of money, even though the day before they didn't.
Yes.
Think they had any.
It happens all the time. Mm-hmm. But that's why it's very important to get these titles. Last thing you want to do is pay someone directly for a property, have them deed it to you. But what they deeded you is maybe an eighth of a portion of eighth of the ownership of a particular property. Then what are you going to do? Share the property with these other heirs that you don't know. And You know, right. It's a bad situation. So don't put yourself in it.
Right. And then the reason for the title policy is sometimes things come up that nobody foresaw coming, you know, like happening. And then the title policy is written, it's their job to protect against that. And they protect against the purchase price, not the resale price. That's another thing to remember. So you hopefully get your money back. You're not going to be made whole in what you thought you would get from it.
Yeah.
Do you have any examples of times we've had to use it?
I've got one right now that we're actually
working on.
Have we
closed on it yet? Or has it been
reached? Yeah, we own the property.
But has it, the resolution been met?
No.
Okay. Mm-mm. So what's one that resolution's been met? Anything?
No, I never had one where
resolution. No. Well, we bought a house one time.
We did. They caught a problem as we were buying it, mm-hmm. and had to be resolved before we could actually close on the purchase. Yeah. So that type of thing does happen quite frequently. But
the house was actually a quarter of the house was on someone else's property.
Yeah. There was a portion of the legal description that got left off on a deed transferring, a previous deed that transferred the property. So it just wasn't, it was a paperwork problem, basically. Right. That had to get fixed.
But we do see like title policies, like, you know, having to be needed.
Yeah. And the big thing is actually, the search,
right. And then, in the house we were buying, the seller went back to their title policy. That's who kind of fixed it all and made everybody whole, per se. So the policy did get used. It wasn't the one we were buying. It was the...
Right. And that's the thing. A lot of times, issues come up in their title search when they're researching property for purchase. And then these issues have to get resolved before you can actually close on the purchase. So a lot of times they are able to resolve these types of issues, but you need to know about them before you close on them and make sure that it's handled properly before you actually close on the deal.
Right.
So and then also it brings up other things in their research about a particular property that you wouldn't have known about before. It could be back property taxes, could be other easements that you don't know about, could be that it was registered as a dump back in the 50s. We've seen that happen before. So
yeah, it doesn't all look kinds like of things. It. You would never know. It looks gorgeous and
green,
beautiful land, and everything's fine. But there's something hiding underneath the soil.
Yes, it used to be a landfill. Yeah. Okay, number 12. We're finally at the end of our list here. So this one is buying land without understanding oil, gas, or mineral rights.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is a big deal in some areas. Other areas, it's a non-issue at all.
Right.
But what that means is that there's the land itself, and then there are the oil, gas, and mineral rights below the property, generally. So it could be rights to drill for oil on that property. It could be rights to mine for coal or mine for any sort of minerals. So what happens is in some of these areas, their people own the land, the surface rights, basically, but they don't own the oil, gas, or mineral rights. That was sold off maybe before they even got the property, or maybe they sold it to someone while they owned the property. And typically, we're looking to buy the land and any of the rights below the property. Now, in some areas, it's completely customary where all the oil, gas, and mineral rights for the whole area have been sold off to someone at some point in the past because that was kind of a valuable area for coal or oil drilling or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it would be rare to find properties that include those oil, gas, and mineral rights. But one thing that I should note is that if you don't own the oil, gas, and mineral rights for a property, then someone else who owns them can actually, they have the right to come onto your property that you're buying, either set up a drilling operation, set up a mining operation on your property where you've got a house, you know, and then someone has the right to come and mine on your property. I mean, how terrible does that sound? So this is one of those things where you need to do your research. You know, we've owned properties where it didn't include mineral rights, but it didn't matter because that area has no valuable minerals in it anyhow. So it's not like anyone's going to set up a mining operation there because there's no commercial value to what's there.
That's why you need to know the local area and why you need a good broker in the area. Because, you know, you might freak out and be like, we don't buy it without this. You talk to a local broker and they're like, no one does. And no one's coming for what they're looking. That was 200 years ago or 100 years ago when, you know.
So do your research on that, and really understand what it is you're buying. So, and those are our 12 critical mistakes that you can make when buying a piece of land. And hopefully by going through this list, you've learned to identify some of these things before they turn into actual problems.
That's the goal, right? I'm pulling up. Okay, so we're segmenting to our next section.
Yes. So what we're doing now is we do this at the end of every podcast. We cherry pick four questions from our Land Conquest community, which is hosted on the School platform. You can also find it by going to school.com/landconquest. So I picked out four questions for Heather to read, and then she's going to read them and we'll see how we're going to answer them, right? Do you have a great deal under contract? We'll submit it to partnerwithpete.com. The Partner with Pete program is a deal funding program where we will actually use our funds to complete the purchase of the property. We will do every other step of the process, including the due diligence, the transaction side, the marketing side, and the transaction on the resale side. And when all the dust settles, we will split the profits 50-50. There is no downside for you as an investor, only upside. So once again, go to partnerwithpete.com, submit your deal there, and let's get it funded.
Okay, sounds good. So Mohammed says he's got a newbie question. Hey, all newbie here. I'm currently in the process of buying my first piece of land and I have a few questions. If the seller is saying she wants to use a local closing company to close the deal, should I still be looking to locate a closing company as well? Or should those processes be going through the local company she has in mind?
Yeah, so typically, you're typically just using one closing company to handle the transaction. Now, a lot of times, this is a common thing. Some sellers will say, well, I'll only do this if we can use my local, you know, title or escrow company, whatever the case is. And we're typically fine with that. You know, whatever makes the seller most comfortable. A lot of these services are the same. Sometimes we run into some bad ones. Sometimes we run into ones that are not professional or whatever. But typically we will go with that because that's what makes a seller most comfortable.
They all have the same level. They all have to be a fiduciary, should point out. Like if they're following the rules, they're not.
There are some exceptions to that. Like sometimes in some of the attorney closing states, they are representing, you know, whoever, you know, contacts them or whatever. But you can ask them to prepare your documents and things as well.
Yeah, and I guess so, you could have your attorney look at it too if you needed to.
So you could bring in another attorney in an attorney state. In some states like New York, in some areas, they require you to each have an attorney for your side and their side. So things like that come up as well. But generally, we are just kind of using whoever the seller wants to use. And if they don't have anyone, if they're not bringing it up and saying, oh, I want to use this company, then we generally will just open it up with whoever we want to use.
Yeah, I think it's more likely they'd say, I want to use my closing attorney than my closing company. Like they, people aren't normally partial to their
title. Yeah, I mean, they might have like a Chicago title down the road that they want to use, or, you know, that happens like all the time. So,
but that's not the big, it's not that big of a deal. And then there's some places where the buyer has the right to, like when you're reselling it, like it'd be a lot easier if we could use our closing, the person we bought it with, but sometimes there's...
Yeah, sometimes it gets negotiated in the contract and they get to decide who they want to use, so...
Ashley says, high demand area. How to find out high demand areas for land in your local market? Any recommended tools? Thanks.
Yeah, so the best tool that we use are just the online sites where you can look up properties for that have sold and are for sale.
I thought you were going to say.
Yeah, up here. I know it all. So those sites would be Zillow or Redfin are generally the two that we use the most. And you can find out pretty easily. We have a sold to for sale ratio, which we talk about in our Land Conquest course. But what it is
it's a training program.
Yes. And what that ratio is trying to determine is how active is that area. And we're looking at, we might take a particular county and a certain acreage range within that county, say 10 to 20 acres. We'll look up land and see how many properties have sold within that range over the past year. Now, and then we look at like, okay, now how many are on the market for sale in that range? And by looking at that ratio, we can determine how active that market is. We can also see how many properties have sold and, so we can get a real good feel for what that market is like. Just gonna nod your head.
I'm doing the awkward silence to see if you what you're doing. It worked. Great. Okay, Jose says pulling list. When pulling list, do you include unknown sales date? I have only been pulling lists with last known sales date, but I see there is much more data to pull when I include unknown sales date. Do you include this in your search? Would like to know what filters other investors are using. Thanks.
Okay, so yes, this is and that's one of those things. The data that we're looking at generally from these are, they come from the assessor's office, you know, like the county data for a particular property. And a lot of times that data is incomplete. They've got good data on some properties, other properties they don't have good data. Could have been just that the last transfer was a long time ago. Could have been that the person didn't enter the data when they did the last transfer. Can be all kinds of reasons, but I wouldn't leave off those properties. You know, a lot of times people are pulling lists and they're trying to come up with the best filters possible to have a super targeted list. And while I do think that's a good strategy if you're trying to make a real laser focused type list,
especially in a busy, like if there's tons and tons of transactions, that might be even easier to.
Yeah. Or if you're getting started, you know, you're getting started and you want to make sure that your mailing list is as fruitful as possible. I might go with more and more filters. Things that I see a lot people do are like, okay, only properties that have been owned for at least 10 years. You know, you can filter for stuff like out of area owners only. You can obviously do the acreage range and stuff like that. You can filter out like super low assessed values. That's sometimes a thing in certain areas. It could mean that it's a junky property or a landlocked property if it's got a super low assessed value. But some areas it means nothing. But
then you're missing all. That's your whole point. Is yeah, like you're missing. So
you're
much
missing.
Then.
You're missing it. Yeah, you're missing certain properties. So it's a trade off. You know, you could try to build a super laser focused list, but then obviously you're going to be probably taking out potential deals of other properties as well. So it's a balancing act and it's a trade-off.
Right.
So.
And I think the more you do it, it'll naturally feel right. Mm-hmm. You know, and you're going to also, when you're doing those filters, your gut's going to be like, yeah, I'm going to drop this one because this doesn't sound right.
Yeah.
You have something super high or super low. I'm not using this. Okay. You ready for another one?
I'm ready. Fire away, Heather. Okay.
Dennis says, purchase agreement. I'm sending out blind offers now. If I get a signed purchase agreement back, do I sign it, then start due diligence? Or after quick research and it would be potential deal, sign it, then start the due diligence? I would think the latter. Thanks.
Yes, Dennis, you are correct. It is the latter. So this happens a lot. You get a signed purchase agreement in the mail. First thing we're doing is we are looking it up, seeing if it's a property we actually want to buy. That would be stuff like, you know, we've got obvious things that disqualify a property, you know, like for us, we don't buy landlocked properties. So if we look at the map and we see that it's clearly a landlocked property, then it's not something we're going to go forward with.
Because there's no point in signing it.
Right.
That's the whole thing. You're just creating extra drama for everybody, extra resistance, extra work.
Yeah. Go on. So we want to make sure it's a property that we want to buy. Also, we want to make sure that the value is where we need to be as well. So when we're sending out our offers, we're generally doing offers based off of averages for a particular area. Now, the property that comes in, it might be below average, might be above average, might be, you know, right at the average. So we want to make sure that the value that we offered fits within our criteria. Say, for instance, the property comes in, it might be a property that you want to buy, but the property is below average. It's got some things like it's got wetlands. It's got more slope than you want. It's got the access. Isn't that great? So you want to look at each property individually, see how the value lines up. But you know, if everything lines up, like if the value's where you need it to be, if it's a property that you want to buy, then you sign it, call up or communicate with the seller, let them know that you've got their offer, you're moving forward with it. Here are the next steps. So you do that. Now, if you're off on the pricing, something like that, then I would call them up and say, hey, you know, thanks for signing and send this back. I didn't realize that there was so much slope to this property. I'm still interested in buying it, but we would need to be at this price in order to make it work. You know, so you try to renegotiate in that way. And then in cases where it's a property that you simply do not want, what I would do is I would call them up and say, hey, you know, I didn't realize this property is landlocked. Unfortunately, I can't move forward with this. But we're buying lots of properties. What else do you have that you'd like to sell? Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times these people own multiple properties and they
might be collectors.
They might have just responded on the one that you sent the letter on. They might own properties in many other areas or other properties in that same county or whatever. So definitely always try to pursue that. Don't just like rip it up and not try to ask about other properties, because we've gotten a lot of deals that way.
Do you have time for a question?
I do, sure.
Give me some more information on how many offers we get signed back that we have to renegotiate. That could be higher or lower. Someone might come to us and say, this is too, I want to sell, but I need more money. Or they sign it right away and then you realize, yeah, it's like half a slope. Mm-hmm. You still want to buy it, but
I would say most properties, I would say 75% of them, we have to renegotiate. Mm-hmm. We're going to be different in some way.
Right. So, either higher or lower or something
right.
like that.
And then sometimes we hit it right on, but like it's unrealistic to think that every property that comes in is going to be exactly average.
Do you think a lot of people who just get into this think that it is going to be just something where they send out an offer, it gets signed and it gets back?
Yes. because I know there's people out there training that. And that's what I thought at the beginning as well. Mm-hmm. So I assume that if they sign an offer, then it's great. We move forward with it and just and go towards closing. But there's just a lot more that goes into it.
And then what are some, I mean, I think that's important to know so that you're not shocked when you get into this, like someone responds back and you have to do that.
Yeah.
Everything's a negotiation. And the big deal is that you want to buy something. And if they're responding, they want to sell something.
Yeah. The motivation's there. Mm-hmm. They want to sell. You want to buy. You got to make sure it's a property that you want to buy, that you see some profit potential in. And then, so both sides have to be aligned and be on the same page.
What other than actual the money do other do sellers want to negotiate?
Normally it's about the money, but it could be a timing thing. Sometimes, you know, we've had people that are like, hey, I got to close this thing in 2 weeks. Obviously that may or may not be possible, but we have that come up sometimes. Sometimes people say, I can't sell this. I want to sell, but I can't sell till 2025. That happens too. So we keep those, we sign the contract, but then, you know, we actually don't close on it until the next year. So that timing and money are a big thing. Sometimes some sellers will try to put conditions on the sale, like, oh, I don't want to sell if you're going to like subdivide this property and do all this stuff. So sometimes sellers will try to do things like that. And we clearly explain that we can't, you know, abide by these conditions, you know? So if you don't want to sell it, that's fine. But we can't commit to something like that. So.
Right. Right. Any other odd things that have come up that...
Well, you know, sometimes people will say like they want to use this closing company or... You know, they want to have some of the proceeds go to their aunt or, you know, things like that. But they, all those things are generally
fine.
Do
you do that? Will you try to accommodate things like that?
I mean, that would be from their side. We just tell them, hey, you know, like you would just have to specify how you want the proceeds dispersed through the closing company.
Anything that's been a deal breaker that you haven't been able to do that you can think of?
Yeah, it's some people that want to restrict how we use the property. That's the main thing.
Anyone ever ask to be paid in like cash or coin or
gold? Some people, that's a good question. Yeah, we had someone that wanted to be paid in gold coins one time. Someone that wanted to be paid in cash. Obviously, that's not anything we could do. I mean, I guess you could if the property was cheap enough, but you know, a lot of times you're not going to be, you know, walking a briefcase of $50,000 to a person. So
getting on a plane, flying out there, arranging with the bank to order that kind of cash.
Yes, it's possible. I don't know. But the last thing I want to do is break any sort of legal rules and stuff too. We want to do everything above board. So, you know, you just don't know what their motivation is for something like that sometimes. So obviously you can't control what they do, but you just want to make sure from your side that you're doing everything legitimately.
Right. So. And using a title company or closing company or something is normally the best way to do it.
Yes. Always the best way to do it.
Okay. Well, this has been really fun. I'll try to think of some more hard-hitting questions to grill you for next time. But thank you everyone for joining us. Pete, where can everyone find you?
Yes. On TikTok. I am at Partner with Pete. I don't do any dancing or anything like that. I just post clips of different things. On Instagram, it's the
same
thing.
You're welcome for that.
Yeah, thanks for the dance. At Partner with Pete on Instagram. Definitely in the Land Conquest community, landconquest.com. And then also I'm on LinkedIn too.
Are you?
Yes. I don't ever really go on LinkedIn, but I do. I do get messages and I respond to those messages there.
Okay, great. Well, this was another episode brought to you by Pete Reese and Associates. No, I'm just kidding. We'll see you next time.
Well, thanks for watching.
Bye.
All right. Bye.
Ready to start turning profit yourself? Head to turningprofit.com to step up your real estate investing game. See you on the next episode.